The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Green Front, where I strive to bring you the most important and interesting stories from the environmental front lines each week. News and views you can use, as I like to say. On today's program, we will get a first-hand report from the UN Climate Conference, where the gathering of world representatives is in its second week of discussions, with just a few more days to go to reach some very important agreements. Let's hope so. We'll find out how the talks are progressing or not from Debbie Barker. She's the International Director for the Center for Food Safety. Next, we'll turn to the safety of money, our money, or more accurately, a controversial chemical that has been found in our beloved cold hard cash that we all handle every day, usually going out, but sometimes coming in. We'll talk to the author of a just-completed study from the Washington Toxics Coalition. Want to not waste any time in bringing you the latest news from Cancun. Debbie Barker is the International Program Director for the Center for Food Safety. She is just back from spending, I think, about a week down in Cancun at the climate talks, and she's here to tell us how things are going. Kind of a mixed bag from what I've read. Welcome to the Green Front, Debbie.
Thank you very much.
Now, you were there specifically with food and agriculture issues in mind as they relate to climate change. But before we get to that specific challenge and what's being done or not on that front, tell us your overall impression. We checked in with Randy Hayes, who was down there representing your organization last week, and things were just getting started. So how did they progress in the past 7 days?
Right. Well, unfortunately, I think the same kind of stalemate that we found in Copenhagen is really the same situation in what we have in Cancun, meaning all of the conditions are the same, and they were some intractable positions on these issues, and they have not made any progress toward breaking down any of these barriers or breaking down the stalemate.
Now, I did get a blurb today that came in from Cancun. It says the U.S. and China have significantly narrowed their differences on the verification of reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, providing hope for the U.N. conference. But with just a few days left, I don't know how realistic that is. The verification issue, I guess, of course, cuts deeply on matters of national sovereignty, international trust, all these sort of subtextual issues that, as you said, led to an impasse in Copenhagen. Do you know if this development in the last couple of days is significant, or is this just the general mood being cautious optimism and both China and the U.S. moving a little bit but not nearly enough? And then Todd Stern, the chief U.S. climate change negotiator, saying, I do think there is an agreement to be had. Quote, at the same time, there are a lot of difficulties, so we'll have to see. So nothing real concrete there, but at least from this dispatch, which came in this morning from the New York Times, maybe there's a little bit of a glimmer of hope. And, of course, we need a lot more than a glimmer, don't we?
Yes, and I'm sure that just as the Copenhagen Accord was, quote, agreed to or came out of Copenhagen, I think most people who've been working on this issue for many years, and even most governments, even perhaps behind closed doors, would admit that the Copenhagen Accord, while publicly they had to say that that was progress and some kind of agreement, mm-hmm. I think I interpret the press release coming out of the New York Times or the media on the China-U.S. Move toward verification as another kind of, I don't want to say a stunt, because certainly there are, I'm sure, some progress being made on that front, but whether or not it's really substantive and whether it's binding and whether it is meaningful to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the levels and as quickly as we need to, that is not the case at this point in the negotiations. And I don't think there's really any other indications to believe that we will come out of Cancun with any kind of agreement that will reduce emissions at the levels that we need them to be reduced.
And another one of the reports that came out last week that was causing quite a bit of stir, and we tried to reach him, is some comments made by Ronnie Jumeau, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and he represents the Alliance of Small Island States, which are, of course, already suffering the effects of climate change. Well, he said they are furious that the large nations that are the big emitters of greenhouse gases, we certainly are not doing more to ensure their survival. And a quote here, he says, I will not shut up. He is with the delegation from Seychelles, an Indian Ocean island, and even when we're underwater, he says, when the bubbles pop, you'll hear us yelling. So he is really trying to speak out for action, saying he doesn't have much patience since these things are so urgent right now. He says, pledges mean nothing. He says, bring us something that lands on the table with a chunk. With a clunk, excuse me. Probably a chunk of change is what he's talking about.
Yes, they're probably accompanied by that. But it's very one thing that is very impressive and perhaps, I guess the word would be heartening to see both in Copenhagen and in Cancun is the way that many of these small islands and small nations, most of which will feel and already are feeling the impacts of climate change the most, have been saying to the big players such as the U.S., you can't bully us. We're not going to back down. We really need to see some really significant commitments and meaningful commitments from you all and back it up with action and the funding that is needed for this. So that is, I've been there both of those, all of the conferences, and those smaller nations are really taking up the flag for really people all over the globe and saying we want really verifiable, meaningful commitments. The situation and the reason why I say that the same conditions that there was a stalemate in Copenhagen are still the same in Cancun is that, I mean, the U.S. is historically the largest greenhouse gas emitter. Even today we are, I think, now just behind China, the largest greenhouse gas emitter. But yet we have brought nothing to the table as far as having any kind of domestic agenda or legislation to show that domestically we are serious about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And if anything, I think this year in Copenhagen, there's even kind of more egg on the face, if you will, of the U.S. negotiators there, because the world knows that we failed this last year to pass any kind of energy climate legislation. So it's just highly doubt, ridden among other nations is how serious is the U.S. in making any kind of commitments. And it's hard for the U.S. then to also tell the other nations what they should be doing when we can't, keep our own house in order or clean up our own house, so to speak.
Boy, this certainly has a deja vu feeling here. They're meeting in December at the end of the year, just like Copenhagen, which turned to Hopenhagen, which turned to Nopenhagen, of course. Mm-hmm. And that was, as we were waiting for the Senate to act on this critical climate change legislation after the House had bravely done so in June, some 6 months prior. And here we are, the Senate now has actively dropped the legislation and going into yet another, climate conference when the U.S. has not only not gotten around to it yet, but it's off the stove, not even just the front burner. So there is reason for pessimism and anger, I would think. I mean, we feel it, many of us who are concerned about climate change, certainly in this country, but I can only imagine those countries that are feeling the effects of our greenhouse gas emissions. After all, we are 4 to 5% of the world's population. We use 25% or so of the world's resources and create that much waste and emissions. So we're out of whack still, and yet we're not showing leadership on this very critical issue. And it seems, in this country at least, it's really not even, making news much anymore.
Yes, I think you've outlined that quite well, is that the other nations are really looking to the U.S. as having a lack of credibility on this issue. And as I say, in Cancun, I think it's even more evident that we haven't been as serious about reducing greenhouse gases due to our lack of action the year between Copenhagen and Cancun. And another political aspect of this is that the only kind of positive or the tool that Obama, when he went to Copenhagen, was able to bring to the rest of the world is to say, okay, yes, we don't have any legislation passed yet on this. I will work on it this year. But what we do have is the Environmental Protection Agency will legislate greenhouse gas emissions, and therefore we will will use that as a very powerful tool to help reduce our emissions, and we can make commitments based on that. Well, flash, you know, here we are
a year later.
No legislation, and the really there's the scary part of this, I guess, is that within Congress now there's a move to actually shut down that EPA mandate, if you will. Actually, it was a result of a Supreme Court ruling that the EPA had to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. But Congress is now making a move. There's talk of making a move to take away some of that authority from the EPA. So that will even lessen our credibility, and it gives the administration even fewer tools from which to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
And that brings me to have two phrases top of mind, and that is one, it's the height of chutzpah, isn't it, saying, you know, you can't have it both ways. That's what we're saying. You know, it's either or. If you are not going to show leadership on legislation, then, you know, government regulations are going to have to step in, and many of these Republican climate change deniers who are now in office in greater number after the November 2nd election are saying, no, we're going to fight that too. And I can only wonder, as I'm sure you do, what planet do they have plans to live on, you know, and what kind of future are they, you know, expecting their children and grandchildren have if they're just continuing to fight for the narrow special interests, but, you know, the vocal minority. They're very loud, the opponents to climate change action, and yet they're a minority of the American people.
Right, yeah. Our country politically on the issue of climate change is really clearly out of step with every other, not only industrialized nation, but really nation on the planet. And that's very unfortunate because, as you say, there's no boundaries when it comes to climate change and the effects of emissions. We don't have clear national boundaries. It affects the entire planet and all of us. But I think the thing that this shows is kind of lack of political will and action on international and national perspective is that there are things that communities are going to now have to take more charge of their situation and lives, if you will. And the exciting thing is that, and we are working on food and agriculture issues, and through making choices about your food systems, you can actually have a huge impact on reducing your greenhouse gas emissions. So, for example, it's estimated that industrial agriculture emissions represent about 30% of total greenhouse gas emissions. Now, this is actually a new report that came out from the World Bank a few months ago, and what it's saying is that, obviously, agriculture is a much bigger player toward emissions than was ever really noted before. So that means that, and we have studies and research that show organic agriculture not only sequesters carbon in the soil instead of emitting it, but it also reduces or eliminates the pesticide and fertilizer use that is another major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions.
I was talking to a friend who I respect and have known for a long time, and we got into a discussion yesterday because she said she's starting to have doubts about whether climate change is real based on what she's hearing, and if it was, you know, so definite, why is there so much controversy, to which I groaned and wanted to say, you've been drinking the Kool-Aid. And I asked if I could send her some, you know, documentation that the majority of credible scientists, 97-98%, believe climate change is real, that humans are causing it. And as we went back and forth a few times, she said, well, I heard that, a meat-eating Prius driver is causing more harm than a vegetarian Hummer driver. And that, of course, spoke to what resources go into, you know, our meat-loving culture. So this is also a big factor. I don't know if that, you know, statistic is true, but it's provocative. It's food for thought or fuel for thought. I guess food for thought would be appropriate here. That it's not so simple. And she was saying, well, even if it is real, I love to travel and I'm not going to give up my, you know, air travel. And it's like, well, you don't have to, but how about carbon offsets? Hopefully we're going to develop biofuels to fuel our planes, but maybe you could travel a little less. And she was saying, you know, even if it's true, what can I do? I live in Marin County and I still see most people not taking their cloth bags into the store. It can get kind of discouraging when people are either not sure of the science, don't really want to read any more on it than what opinion they've already formed. And again, this is a very educated, cultured woman, friend of mine, and yet it seemed like she was really starting to doubt it and wondering, even if it is true, why should I change my habits when China, and she did mention China, and so kind of brings it back to this conversation right here. What would you say in that situation? I kind of pulled out all my arguments and then decided the friendship, I didn't want to risk the friendship by going any further.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's somewhat understandable for people to be climate fatigued, if you will. I mean, if our world leaders and national leaders aren't seeming to take this problem very seriously, then it's hard for everyday folks, if you will, to kind of get a grasp then of how serious, in fact, the issue is. Now, the science, it's clearly out there. I mean, I would just point to IPCC reports, even World Bank reports, numerous data on climate change statistics, and that man is causing this. So I won't really go much farther than that. People can read on that if they want. However,
so often they don't want to, though. What's that about? I guess it's just like overload, overwhelm. They don't really, they want to form their opinion and not have to worry about it, it seems.
Perhaps,
not
you know,
everyone.
And I can't really speak to that because, you know, everyone has their own
right.
Reason.
Right. Eco-psychology and sociology, a topic that fascinates
that.
Me. So
yeah,
I just always
exactly.
like to get some opinion on that.
But
because
one thing
what we're up against, isn't it, really, what we're up against in large part, is the public not really being sure, the confusion factor purported, perpetuated by, the mainstream media dominated by Fox Television News and right-wing radio hosts.
Right, that's a factor. I think, though, a lot of it is that people don't know what they can do, and they feel rather powerless. And again, that's why I kind of we like to bring around the issue of food systems and to show that people can actually, regardless of what does or does not happen in this international treaty level, what does or does not happen in U.S. legislation, communities can make a huge difference, and individuals can make a huge difference. Now, let me just give you, she mentioned the, liking her, the meat-eating Prius driver or whatever. I just want to say, I mean, yes, certainly while intensive industrial livestock does contribute a significant portion of greenhouse gas emissions, I think even so, for example, let me just give you a statistic about whether you're a meat eater or not. For all of 60% of nitrous oxide emissions globally, and nitrous oxide is the most potent greenhouse gas. Approximately 60% of those emissions are caused by the use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. That's going on every vegetable crop, that you're eating if it's not organic. So just by simply, as a consumer, if you're purchasing organic produce, right there, you're just doing a huge bit, and it's significant. 60% is a huge amount of emissions of this very potent greenhouse gas.
So it's greater than carbon dioxide in terms of overall emissions?
For agriculture, the largest emissions come from methane and then also nitrous oxide.
Those are agriculture. Two, okay, got
yeah,
it.
Yeah, specifically. So that's where we can really make some change, not only in our daily habits, but then, for example, if you are an organic farmer or if you're someone who's working in your community or state level and wanting to have further reasons besides the good reasons we know to have organic, but even to add reducing carbon, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, conversion to organic agriculture is a huge factor in that and can really make a difference. And if communities around the world adopt these practices, for example, a study at the Rodell Institute says that the U.S. could reduce about 25% of its current CO equivalent emissions if we converted all of our soil that's currently growing food to ecological organic farming methods. I think that's a pretty exciting statistic and something that can give us hope moving forward when we know that our leaders aren't necessarily doing that.
And certainly, who could argue with that? It sounds like a great goal. But I remember doing an interview with someone about 5 years ago who had done some research, and she was certainly, or her organization was a proponent of this kind of transition. The scalability was a big challenge and was sort of addressing comments, criticism that, you know, it's fine to talk about really, you know, transforming the way food is grown across the planet, but it's just not realistic in terms of either costs or, you know, land. What do you think about that? Is that changing, or was that just one opinion? And have you, you know, have seen or can you cite other research that shows that, no, if we really have the will, this is quite plausible, and or at least in a too significant degree?
Right. Well, there are many levels and ways to approach that question, but as far as can this happen, again, I'll take the example of the use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. We have known alternatives to that. That could happen. It doesn't take a lot of money. In fact, the alternatives to using synthetic nitrogen fertilizers are cheaper than using the synthetic chemical now. So that, as far as a cost issue, there's really, that's almost a non-issue. I mean, obviously there are kind of educational factors, you know, on-farm education about how to convert the use away from these synthetic chemicals to the more natural regenerative fertilizers. But that's just something that absolutely isn't going to cost a lot of money, can easily be done on existing land as it is now, and it doesn't matter what your scale is. It could be done on large plots of land and small, you know, cropping lands.
Okay, and tell us what are some other things that people and communities can do, since we're not seeing the national, international leadership that we need, as I move away from the fax machine here.
Well, as I say, since we're focused on climate and agriculture links, buying organic makes a huge difference. And also, you know, while it's true reducing meat consumption is also another factor. I mean, people make their personal choices on whether they eat meat or not, and I'm not here to speak to that. But certainly organic meat, again, is a much, as far as climate emissions, produces fewer emissions than industrial meat. And then reducing your intake of meat in general can also help to reduce emissions, primarily of methane gases and nitrous oxide again. So I just can't stress enough how your everyday actions can make a significant impact. On a regional, though, and state level, if you're in communities that are considering, you know, that have some farmer groups, start to engage with those groups and start to engage how can we make our conversion from chemical-intensive farming to organic regenerative farming, and how can we rebuild our soils. And know that probably if you do that on your local levels and in enough local levels and state levels initiate programs like that, you're going to be doing more than any international agreement could accomplish. Just
very
by sheer
empowering
numbers.
And inspiring also to frequent farmers markets, which are very popular in my area, and hopefully, you know, on the increase across the country.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's just in our last few minutes talk about sort of what you left Cancun with. I certainly hear frustration. How did it compare to what your expectations were going into it?
Well, I had basically the expectation that nothing would be different this time around, and unfortunately that seems to be the case. It just redoubled, I guess, my passion, if you will, into believing that while governments probably are not going to act on this, while they are not acting quickly enough on this issue, that we'll have to empower ourselves as individuals and communities. And the fact that we can do this, as I said, through food systems and agriculture, which is the largest, when you take all of the other sectors, that is the largest block of emission, where the emissions come from. As I said, 30% of total global emissions are related to agriculture and food. That's something that governments don't need to act on. I mean, while it's good that we do want to work on policy on our both national and international levels, we can also do things on the community level that will really make an impact. And I think it's those people's movements, communities, that are really the hope to turning around the damage from greenhouse gas emissions.
And, you know, many of us are tuned into this, especially where, you know, we live. I live in the very Green Bay area in Portland, Seattle. You're in Washington, I believe. Do you see, you know, that people understand these connections and are starting to make different choices? Because I do believe that, you know, we have to start in our own home and community and go out from there. And yet it seems many Americans still are not connecting the dots or don't understand what they can do. And that's where, of course, I'll put in a little self-promoting plug here. You would think the nation might be able to use one green talk show on, you know, mainstream network syndicated airwaves. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is missing part of it, is if it really is increasingly up to us, you can't do, you know, what you don't understand.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, we work on those fronts as well, right, educating the media and becoming part of the solution-oriented or green media, if you want to call it that. But I think also we can know then, having this tool of knowing that organic agriculture, for example, is directly related to climate, we can use that as a tool in the organic farming community and farmers markets as an educational tool to help spread the word. And I think that then also brings another piece to educate folks that may not be as fortunate to live in some of these areas like California and Oregon, where there's a lot of organic industry going on. So,
and last question before we let you go. Just wondered, you know, since you said you went into these negotiations with pretty low expectations, I guess the question would be, well, then why go? You were not disappointed. You're disappointed, but not disappointed, not surprised, I should say. Is there something about being there and bearing witness and perhaps talking with other NGOs that really, you think, makes a difference? If nothing else, it's kind of empowering to see other people working so hard from around the country and the globe. Was it worth, you know, going? Well, Cancun's always a nice place to go, but mm-hmm. you feel like it was worth your time and energy to be there?
Well, I'll tell you why we go, and I think other civil society groups who are there as well are going for several reasons. One reason is you go there to meet your civil society and other NGO colleagues from around the world, and you do that to exchange really critical information. For example, I'm learning about how farming systems in Africa are reducing their emissions, and you get that kind of data and research and science that you just don't really often find, say, even surfing the net. It's those face-to-face connections, that building of trust to share information, that's very, very valuable information. Also, and to bring solidarity as well as, you know, the marches and the public outside activity, if you will, is very important to show those negotiators on the inside that someone is watching and someone really is monitoring what is happening or what is not happening. So that's a reason to go. Another reason to go is some of us get the opportunity to meet with some of the government leaders who are on the inside of the negotiations, if you will, and we can talk through what some of our concerns are and actually use it as an education, a time to educate them, because they actually don't have sometimes information to know whether, you know, to support something or to oppose something that could be harmful. And we can use that often to meet with those folks so that they can take that information on the inside negotiating track, if you will. So that can be extremely valuable. And it's often in the form of stopping harms from happening. So, for example, genetically engineered seeds and crops are being brought forward by the ag industry as a climate solution. And they're very much, you know, talking to government leaders who are on the inside of the UN to say this is something that should have emission credits, et cetera, because it's great. It reduces greenhouse gases. We say that is a false solution, and we have plenty of science to show why it is. And we can then meet with those government leaders as well to debunk the myths that they've been told about this technology and hopefully then stop that bad thing from happening. It may not produce, you know, it may not mean that there's an agreement in the UNFCCC, but it could mean that that aspect of a potential agreement is left out of the agreement, which would be a good thing.
Well, Debbie Barker, I'm encouraged to know that you are there and you are doing great work with the Center for Food Safety. Continue to speak loud and widely and spread the message that we need to take things into our own hands. There are solutions at hand, but we need to get active yesterday, all of us. So thanks so much. Debbie Barker is the International Program Director for the Center for Food Safety. We'll check back with you in a few months and see, you know, some of the projects that you're working on beyond the Cancun conference. And let's hope for a miracle. Maybe they will pull something out in the form of agreement in the next couple of days.
Well, I want to be proven wrong, absolutely.
A Christmas miracle, perhaps.
All right. Thank you much.
Thanks, Debbie.
Okay, bye.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about the color of money. Guess what? It's not green. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. And we can turn it.